Welcome to the Neuromyelitis Optica Spectrum Disorder edition of Rare Disease Advisor's Rare Care Podcast, offering unique perspectives from researchers, clinicians, and influencers from the NMOSD community.
Hello, and welcome to the Rare Care Podcast. This is your host, Larry Luxner, Senior Correspondent for Rare Disease Advisor, reporting from Dallas, Texas, where the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association is holding its 30th annual conference. Our guest is Dr. Anastasia Vishnevetsky, a neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School in Boston. Dr. Vishnevetsky specializes in the conduct and design of clinical trials in neuroimmunology, and her team is about to conduct a phase 2b placebo-controlled clinical trial that looks at nabiximols, a cannabinoid spray to treat symptoms of neuromyelitis optica spectrum disorder, or NMOSD. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Absolutely. Happy to be here.
So this is big news. It's, from what I understand, the first ever trial that that examines the potential for any cannabis product to treat this specific disease, NMOSD.
Yeah, exactly. So the study drug that we're looking at, together with Dr. Michael Levy, who's the PI on this study, is nabiximols. And that is actually approved for the treatment of medication refractory spasticity and multiple sclerosis. Spasticity and multiple sclerosis is in many ways similar to NMOSD, but tends to be more severe and more difficult to control than NMOSD. And nabiximols is also not approved in the United States at all. And so there's kind of twofold goals with this clinical trial. One is to see if we can extrapolate this medication that's shown efficacy in MS and see if it's also effective for those with more severe spasticity related to NMOSD and some of the longer spinal cord lesions that we can see with NMOSD. And then secondly, to see if we can, to some extent, revive the research of nabiximols within the United States.
So currently, nabiximols is not approved at all in the U.S. for any reason?
Correct. It is approved in many countries, I think in most countries in Europe and in many other countries as well, but not for any reason in the United States.
Okay, so let's take a step backwards, and we should point out that it's pretty clear that medical marijuana, so to speak, is not legal in every state in the United States. And certainly recreational use of cannabis is now legal in, I believe, 24 states, if that. How does the legal issue come into play when it comes to clinical trials of this nature?
Yeah, so it increases the complexity of conducting this hugely. To give you a sense of what it's taken to bring this trial to kind of the cusp of enrolling, I should still say that we are still waiting on Dr. Lee's controlled substance registration. So we still do have some regulatory hurdles. But to give you a sense, this project started when I was a fellow and developing it together with Dr. Levy. And that was almost 3 years ago that we started this. At the same time, a different trial that's not using controlled substances, I started working on last January. And we're pretty much at the same point of progress with the two studies because of so much of the regulatory burden and trying to figure out how we're going to conduct this trial.
Now, at this conference that I'm here in Dallas, one of your colleagues presented the results of a survey taken among patients with the disease and as to their attitudes towards cannabis use. From what I understand, a big percentage of these people are already using cannabis in one form or another.
Yeah, exactly. So Melanie Delgado is a research coordinator who works with me and with Dr. Levy as well. And so the survey that we ran, you know, one thing to take with a grain of salt is actually the number of people who said that they're using cannabis, because the survey was open about the fact that it was about the topic of cannabis. So people who have more of an interest in it were more likely to respond to the survey. So I think that it's tough to extrapolate, you know, what is the overall prevalence or overall frequency of use amongst the general population. That being said, we did have, you know, 267 completed responses that we analyzed, which is a pretty big number in such a rare disease space. And out of those, 60% or so, maybe 57% to be more exact, said that they were had used cannabis within the past year. Of those who were using, a very significant proportion said that they were using it daily, or almost daily, or even some multiple times a day. So it absolutely is quite prevalent. And that was the real reason, that was the motivation for me for both conducting the survey as well as for this study, which was I just was increasingly frustrated by having patients ask me very reasonably, you know, that they had heard about cannabinoid use for the treatment of spasticity and pain, or that they found it helpful and they wanted a medical opinion about it. You know, is it safe? What are the side effects? What's the dosing? You know, how can I combine it with my other medications? Very responsible, appropriate questions. And I just had to say, I have no idea. I don't even know what other people are using. I don't even know what other people are doing. I don't know what's safe. I don't know what side effects people are experiencing. And so it was just a frustrating kind of conversation to have over and over again.
Right. And one of the results of the survey that Melanie mentioned during the course of her presentation was that 57 out of 145 said they were using it recreationally and found it was helpful. And that 44 of those 145 said they were doing so upon a doctor's recommendation, but that a significant number of these people did not feel comfortable discussing it even with their doctor.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is, it's a shame that it's not something that's discussed more. I've actually changed my practice. You know, when we learn in medical school how to ask about, you know, social history, you ask about smoking, you ask about alcohol, you can ask about drugs. And I actually no longer ask about cannabis use in the section where I might ask someone about their smoking, alcohol, or drug use. I ask about it when I ask about their medications. And I think that even that small difference is actually helpful to destigmatize and make the conversation a little bit more open. Don't have really any personal experience with using cannabis. This, you know, despite how prevalent the use is, it's something that really came from just how often patients are talking about it. And I really want to make sure that I know, if patients are using it, and also that I start to get a little bit of an experience just from asking. That's really all of my experience, that it comes from asking patients, you know, what works for you. And if I have 10, 20, you know, more patients who say, okay, I'm using it for this, this is what it's helpful for. It's really, really poor data, but it's better than absolutely nothing, which is what we kind of currently have.
And the one of the most common reasons they're using it is to control muscle spasms, pain, of course, and to help sleep.
Yeah. And these are, I think, one of the reasons people in medicine sometimes, colleagues sometimes ask me, you know, how... why are you more open about cannabis use for this symptom relief? Why are you more willing to tell patients it's okay to try cannabis for these symptoms when you don't really know as much about the side effects as we might like? And part of the reason is because a lot of the other medications that we prescribe are quite poorly tolerated and have real side effects, and we shouldn't underplay those. Gabapentin is a common medication, so commonly prescribed, for example. A lot of people do great on it, but I've had many people who gain weight, are very dizzy, have problems with their balance or their thinking, they're retaining water. So there's a lot of potential side effects with all of the medications that we use, and I would love to see cannabis treated more similarly to that. You know, I do want to highlight that we ask people about side effects, and they mentioned that they had, you know, that some people felt like they're thinking, that they had more thinking problems or brain fog.
Brain fog, yes. She mentioned that in the presentation. So I would like to ask you to discuss the design of this trial. How many patients are involved? It's placebo controlled, and I understand that it's a crossover design, meaning that everybody is going to get the drug and everybody is going to get the placebo at some point or another.
Exactly. So we hope to enroll 44 patients with NMOSD. It can be aquaporin 4 positive or seronegative NMOSD. We are not enrolling MOGAD patients or idiopathic transverse myelitis patients at this time. And so essentially everyone will start on either the placebo or on the drug product. And they will, for 2 weeks, they'll actually be escalating their dose to find their own personal kind of optimal dose. And then they'll stay on that dose for 4 weeks. And that's kind of that 6 week total period, 2 weeks of dose escalation, 4 weeks of on staying on a stable dose. That's kind of the first period. And then they'll stop the drug. There'll be a 2 week washout period. And then they'll switch to the other arm, or to the other side. So if they had placebo in the first period, they'll get the investigational drug in the second one. And if they got investigational drug in the first period, they'll get placebo in the second one. And one part of this that's unique as well is that this is going to be a fully, an almost fully remote trial. So almost all of the assessments are going to be done virtually. We are planning to enroll a kind of small sub cohort that is an in-person group that has kind of some extra assessments that we'll use to compare to the virtual assessments, but that's not mandatory. And so folks who are out of state can enroll in the virtual component only.
So this is a spray, meaning, as I understand it, since it's remote, you're basically going to trust the patients to administer themselves as they're supposed to do?
Yeah, so the amount that they're going to receive is going to be just enough for the conduct of the trial. The spray will be initially, we'll have a virtual visit where we'll supervise them in actually administering it, make sure that they're doing it correctly, kind of go through all of the instructions. So there'll be pretty close contact in that way. And then the virtual visits also are almost weekly. There's at least weekly contact of some kind. The formal virtual visits are only a couple times per period that are a little bit longer, but there will be just kind of a check-in a little bit more often.
And when are you expecting to wrap up and make some conclusions?
So I think we are hoping to start enrolling sometime in the spring of 2025. So coming just around the corner. And then I think the whole study, optimistically, we hope will be kind of wrapped up within 2 years. I think that it could take a little bit longer.
And during that time, for all we know, cannabis itself may be rescheduled.
So interestingly, it is not actually going to be helpful for us because we've actually gone through all the hoops for Schedule 1. And now if it is rescheduled to Schedule 3, we will actually have to go through all the hoops for Schedule 3. So currently we have applied for a Schedule 1 controlled substance license, but we do not have a Schedule 3 controlled substance license. So we will have to update and kind of change some of our paperwork if that happens. And it doesn't otherwise, it kind of decreases the scrutiny for some of the things that we've actually already done and gone through. So it won't really directly impact us anymore.
So I want to, before we wrap up, I do want to ask you about the composition of cannabis itself, because right now people who are using the product, it may not be a controlled product. Some of them are using edibles, they're eating it, some are smoking, some are vaping. That also affects the composition of the balance between THC and CBD, and as well as some other endocannabinoids. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, so the Nabiximol spray is a 1-to-1 THC to CBD product, and the kind of pharmacology of the product is really meant to kind of balance out the optimal properties of each. So THC is what contributes to some of the cognitive effects and the high that can occur with marijuana use, but THC also seems to be quite important for pain relief and spasticity relief. So it's not as simple as just saying, you know, just use CBD, which is much less psychoactive. And so what the spray is supposed to do is essentially avoid having as much of a kind of peak of THC that leads to the psychoactive effects, and instead have a kind of slower and more even distribution of the THC. I think in general, it's, you know, it is just, it is a medication or a drug like any other. So it's important to know, you know, exactly what you're taking. And that's why I really want to see this be something that's available as a pharmaceutical product, where people can optimize their dose and, you know, remain on a steady dose while being on other medications that might interact. I think that's quite important. And I do think, you know, a lot of people have asked me about, you know, can I just take the CBD? Cause I don't want to, you know, I have kids at home. I don't want to feel like I have the psychoactive effects, but I want to, you know, I want it for the pain relief or whatever, or I have to work, or whatever it is. And I do think that, for pain and spasticity specifically, I believe, but again, I don't know because we don't have amazing data for this, but I believe that the THC component does play a role.
Wonderful. We're out of time, unfortunately. It's a fascinating topic. And congratulations. It seems like a groundbreaking trial, namely because it's the first that will look at any cannabis product in NMOSD. We've been speaking with Dr. Anastasia Vishnevetsky, a neurologist at Mass General Hospital and Harvard Medical School in Boston. Thank you so much. This is Larry Luxner for Rare Disease Advisor.
Be sure to follow the latest news, perspectives, and clinical resources on rare diseases at rarediseaseadvisor.com. Thank you for listening.